And good Tuesday morning. It is the show on 91.5. Still to come this hour, what is the future for communities in the wake of a net neutrality expected decision coming up later this week by the FCC? And we'll hear from one fire evacuee from Ventura County.
But first, the U.S. Agriculture Department has given Arizona the okay to test out a program the state says is aimed at reducing fraud and illegal trafficking in food stamp cards. There are currently nearly a million Arizonans who get benefits through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Those benefits come in the form of electronic benefit cards. And with me to talk about this two-year waiver granted by the USDA is Cynthia Zwick. She's the executive director of the Arizona Community Action Association. And Cynthia, first off, what do you make of what the state plans to do here?
Well, I think it's sort of a trend that we're starting to see in making it a little bit more difficult to actually receive the benefits, apply for and receive the benefits. Right now, Arizona law requires DES to make contact with SNAP recipients who request more than four replacement EBT cards. This would actually require them to begin making contact after the second request. So the concern that I think many of us have is, you know, first of all, what's that going to cost the state? There's not been any sort of analysis on what it would cost from an administrative staffing perspective to do that. And really, what is the ultimate goal? You know, it's articulated that it's to address fraud. And what we know is that food stamp participation has gone up significantly over the last couple of years, over the last several years, actually, due to the recession. And so I think our concern really is this really just a way to further stigmatize participation and the families that are participating in the program today?
Is the thinking that by having the state contact SNAP recipients if they request a replacement card that the state is concerned that folks maybe didn't lose the card and are just trying to get another one or get more benefits than what they are supposed to be getting?
Yeah, I think the waiver and I think some of the information that's come out of the USDA is indicated that it really is to get to what they're calling SNAP trafficking and see if that's happening in Arizona, and if it is, how do we prevent it? I think the incident of that occurring nationally has gone up a bit, but I think if you really look at who's profiting from any kind of inappropriate behavior, it's really small stores in smaller communities that are actually seeing the benefit of that. And I just want to make sure everybody knows that none of us that work in this arena and, you know, working to end poverty or hunger in the state support anybody who's committing fraud. But we really think it's misplaced attention in that the folks that really are benefiting through any kind of misuse of this program are likely grocers and not the individuals themselves.
So what do you think the ultimate impact of this waiver will be? I mean, do you think the state will find some amount of fraud? Do you think there will be some kind of impact on SNAP recipients?
Well, I hope not. I think it's possible that there will be some. I know that there has been an incident or two over the last probably 5 years where grocers have been identified as benefiting from inappropriate use of the funds. But I would hope that if it does occur, it's minimal, and I would truly hope that it doesn't occur at all.
You mentioned earlier that you're concerned about this. I mean, do you think that SNAP recipients will run into problems based on this?
You know, I don't know that SNAP recipients will run into problems. I think at least not initially, I think the greater impact potentially down the line is more and more barriers to people accessing the benefit. And I think sometimes the responsibility for the misuse is misplaced. And I think we just need to understand that SNAP is a temporary program that helps families through difficult times. It is not a lifetime benefit. And so I think the longer-term concern is that if there is any fraud identified, that it will have greater systemic impact than necessarily, which will ultimately trickle down to have an individual participant impact, if that makes sense.
Understanding that there are different federal agencies involved here with these different programs, do you see this waiver as maybe a sign that there could be other waivers like this given to other sort of benefit programs in the state, for example, drug testing or work requirements or a lifetime cap on benefits, things like that?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is, we're just beginning to see a trend for people to have more sort of hoops to jump. But I think longer term, what this really is sort of leading to is what we've been hearing a lot about lately in the news, where the administration, and I think the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, has indicated that once the tax proposal has gotten through the process, has been signed by the president, which, you know, that's its own process, I think they're turning their sights to welfare reform. And what we think, based on the readings that we've done about those statements and about the intentions, is that it's a couple of things. It's more stringent guidelines for eligibility, so work requirements, drug testing, a variety of other measures. But we also think it's leading to a sincere effort to severely reduce funding, if not eliminate funding, for many of the programs that support our community. So we're really concerned about what the longer-term implications are.
Cynthia Zwick is the executive director of the Arizona Community Action Association. We also reached out to Governor Doug Ducey's office on this. They referred us to a statement he made in a USDA press release saying, quote, "I appreciate Secretary Perdue's willingness to work with states to improve the administration of this program. Through this policy, we can provide a hand up to those in need while ensuring we have the tools necessary to crack down on fraud and protect taxpayers," end quote.
FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has said he wants the commission to repeal net neutrality rules, and that could come as soon as Thursday when he and his four fellow commissioners meet. That has a number of groups concerned about how difficult it may be for certain areas to get efficient web access. Some communities have already taken steps to develop their own internet service, and others are looking into it as well. To talk more about what that could entail, I'm joined by Jason Kebler. He is editor-in-chief of Motherboard. Jason, since the FCC is expected to repeal net neutrality, do you think we're going to see the bigger steps taken by smaller communities to build their own internet infrastructure?
I hope that people will look into building their own internet infrastructure. Already, there are a lot of states that have looked into this, and many cities and local towns have built their own municipal broadband. The fastest internet in the United States is not provided by a major telecom. It's provided by EPB, which is an electric company in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We're starting to see a lot more cities build their own fiber internet to the home, and even nonprofits and community groups building internet infrastructure that otherwise wouldn't be there.
What are the advantages if a large telecom is providing the internet access, and what are the advantages of a city having its own as long as they can make it efficient?
Most of the United States is serviced by a large internet telecom provider. The advantage here is that, for the most part, you know, you don't have to think about it. You call up Comcast or Verizon or Optimum, and they come to your house, install something, and you pay them $50 a month, and you have the internet. The downside here is that they have an enormous amount of control over your service. Often, we don't get the speeds that they advertise. Often, you know, if they don't come to your neighborhood, you're kind of out of luck and you have to go with DSL or even dial-up in many parts of the country. So what we've seen is communities that have been ignored by big telecom are taking matters into their own hands. A lot of these municipal broadband networks are being built in towns and rural areas that don't have a fiber connection via big telecom. So what they're doing is they're passing legislation or ordinances that allow them to basically run fiber directly to their constituents' homes. Oftentimes it's paid for by taxpayer money. Other times it's paid for by grants. Other times it's completely self-financed via bonds and paid back because a lot of these networks are profitable.
And are these trends that you're seeing in more and more places, is there one of those aspects you're seeing more of, whether it's because, you know, obviously with cities and communities, they always have to look so closely at what the budget is like. So when you mentioned grants, that intrigued me as well.
So the beautiful thing about this is that there are many different models for getting online, and it's different depending on population density, other competitors, local government rules and regulations. In some states, governments aren't allowed to be internet service providers, so they build the infrastructure, but then private companies take over the actual operation of it. And then we're also seeing a lot of purely private internet service provider startups. So there's a company called Ting, which was a wireless provider, or still is a wireless provider, but provides fiber internet in Westminster, Maryland, as well as a couple other cities around the country. There's Sonic, which is a big internet provider in California, or rather a small one, but it's one of the more popular and established small internet service providers. And so we're seeing a lot of people take this as a business opportunity because Big telecom companies are often some of the least liked companies in the country because telecom is both difficult, but also because there's no choice. So if you have a bad experience with Comcast, you can't change in many, and you can't change to Verizon in many cases. So what we're seeing is people just trying to build new infrastructure, get online via any means possible. And we're seeing a lot of different models all over the country.
Are there certain pitfalls that a smaller community may run into in trying to set this up that the big telecom wouldn't just because by virtue of being big?
Yeah. So obviously there is, it's expensive to build a true fiber network that runs to everyone's house. You know, you have to dig up the ground. You have to do what's known as last mile, which is connecting, you know, every last house. So if you're not in a densely populated area, that can be really expensive. You know, a lot of these networks struggle to be sustainable. Big telecom companies can subsidize the cost of building in rural areas if they wanted by, you know, raising the prices in other areas or by making profits in other parts of the country. So that is one of the pitfalls of having a small network. The good news is that a lot of the infrastructure is getting a lot cheaper. There's a lot of new advances in terms of wireless infrastructure that is almost as good as wired infrastructure and is obviously much cheaper because you don't have to run, you know, a fiber cable 5 miles down to my neighbor's house. If you live in a rural area, you can just put a big antenna on the top of your barn or something, which is something that we've actually seen in parts of Ohio. You have people climbing up to the top of their grain silos, putting big antennas up there and then servicing, you know, 15, 20 miles worth of area with just one antenna.
The grassroots aspect of this is so fascinating on many levels. And I know this is not an apples to apples comparison, but it sort of reminds some of us about how so many people are cutting the cord or not even taking up the cord because they want to have the choice and make their own choice on this and not be ruled by these big companies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is definitely, I would call it a movement to take ownership of our technology. And that's certainly something we've seen with cord cutting. People want more choice. People want to feel like they have some sort of ownership over what they're doing with their technology. And I think that's what's happening here. We're certainly in the infancy stages of this movement, I'd say. You know, there's a lot of really mature networks that have been built by small governments. But what we're starting to see is a lot of nonprofit and community groups and startup ISPs building in areas as well. The price of a lot of this technology is coming down to the point where you can afford to build a rudimentary network for just a couple $1,000s.
Jason Kebler is editor-in-chief for Motherboard. The FCC is expected to hold its vote on net neutrality on Thursday. The Thomas Fire continues to burn through areas of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties in California. The total reach of the fire is now up to more than 230,000 acres, making it the fifth largest wildfire in that state's history. Homes and structures have been destroyed, and families were evacuated from their homes. Wesley Barr and his family left their home in Ventura more than a week ago because of the advancing blaze, but returned on Sunday night to an intact house with only some smoke damage. And Wesley Barr is with me. So, Wesley, your house is still standing then?
Yeah, yeah, our house is in order. Most of the fire was located north of Foothill Road. We were we're located south of Foothill Road. Foothill Road's about 200 yards up the street. A lot of the houses north of Foothill were heavily damaged, a lot of smoke damage, and obviously a lot of houses had burned down. Right now we're trying to get back to normal.
How hard is that going to be, do you think?
It's not going to take too much effort, I guess, to get things back to normal. Our biggest concern now is air quality. The air from time to time can get quite smoggy. I think last week I came into Ventura to pick up a few things, and you in essence need to wear a mask while you're in your car. It looked like a fog. Even if you turned on your fog lights, it really didn't do much in terms of the air.
Does it seem surreal to be looking around the area, as you said, just 200 yards away, and see some of the damage when you consider what things were like just a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah. I mean, it obviously it looks a lot different. We have hillsides that were burned. Where we currently are in Ventura, we were one of the first areas to kind of get hit in Ventura because it kind of looped around and kind of hit our spot. Some people have already asked me, you know, what happened. And I think the most interesting part about this is, you know, there has been a lot of damage around here, but I think it's the start of the fire is so interesting, because I was at work and I knew nothing about it until I was going down the grade over on the other side of Camarillo, and I made a phone call to my wife. I said, "Is there a fire?" And she had no idea about it. I said, "It looks like a city sprouted up overnight," and because the light pollution was so immense. And by the time I got home, the fire was well behind me. I could see a little bit of a glow out my back passenger window. And I told my wife, I said, just based on where this fire is located and the way the winds are blowing, we might need to think about gathering up some stuff in the morning. Well, I'd say maybe about 45 minutes later, that glow was pretty bright, you know, and I told my wife, we need to gather up the photo albums. We need to think about gathering up paperwork, because we're probably going to have to leave, you know, that night.
Can you compare the emotions of that to when you basically got the all clear earlier this week or over the weekend that you could go back home?
Because things happen so quickly, the first thing that's in your mind is, you know, the safety of your family. I mean, property is property. I think for me, it was gathering up, you know, some of the family heirlooms in terms of, like, you know, photographs and then, you know, paperwork, things that are hard to replace. This was moving so quickly that you didn't really have time to think. We felt that our entire neighborhood's going to burn down. So we left our house knowing that it would be burnt. And later on, finding out that our entire neighborhood wasn't touched was, you know, was a huge relief and also very surprising.
Wesley Barr, he and his family left their home where they were evacuated because of the Ventura fire, and now they are back home, and that's good news. And Wesley, thanks for telling us about that.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome. Appreciate it.
It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for listening this morning. With Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. It is Election Day today in Alabama. It's an off-year special election for a Senate seat. That's one race the country would usually ignore. Well, not this time. Here's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway.
Alabama is not a place Republicans expected to be in a real race with Democrat Doug Jones. Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee is chairman of the Republican Governors Association. And to people like Governor Haslam, the Roy Moore phenomenon is bad news for the future of the GOP.
I think you could have come away with the wrong impression while Obama was in the White House, because there was such a pushback against him that we gained a lot of seats. We gained 10 governor seats. We gained 983 legislative seats around the country. And don't confuse the wind in the face of your opponent with a wind being at your back. We have to figure out a way to reach out to that younger voter as well as the minority voter.
And how do you do that? Look, there have been Republicans like you who've been calling for this for 8 years, and your party has gone in precisely the opposite direction by embracing President Trump. What are the policies? What are the ways that your party would actually appeal to younger voters, to minority voters, and to women voters, when so much of the loudest megaphone message coming from the Oval Office is precisely different?
So I would argue we can do that. Look at the results in governor's races around the country. Greg Abbott in Texas, who did very, very well with Hispanic vote. Charlie Baker, who wins in Massachusetts as a Republican and still has a 70% approval rating, like Governor Hogan does in Maryland, pointing to the fact that we have a Republican governor in Vermont, Bernie Sanders' home state. So my point would be, as Republicans, we have a message that does resonate with folks. But to win in the blue states or even the purple states, we have to have candidates that not only can speak to that message, but have to be comfortable speaking to it.
I get what you're saying, and it's a fine strategy, Governor, and that some of the things that I see are so much different. The Republican National Committee just poured $170,000 into Alabama to help elect Roy Moore, at the direction of the president, of course. But again, if you want to impress young voters, minority voters, and particularly married woman voters, throwing the party's full weight behind Roy Moore probably wasn't a great way to do it.
No, I mean, I would agree with what feels to me like a majority of our Republican senators in Washington who have said, we disagree with that move. That was not a smart move. Forget smart. Is it the right thing to do? And I'll be on the side of those folks who'd say, I don't think that's where the RNC needs to be putting their money. That's not the message of who we want to be. And it's going to, if he does win, it's a problem once he gets to Washington that will continue to be around. So I fully agree that's not a helpful development for the party or for us as we try to win governor's races around the country.
Can you give me an example of one or two policies that you think would be great for Republicans to champion that would appeal to minority voters, voters of color and women without losing, I don't know, what Joe Walsh called his angry white caucus that makes up so much of the Republican base now?
Sure. I'll give you something we've done in Tennessee. Several years ago, we launched the Tennessee Promise, first state to have 2 years free of community college or technical school to everyone. And you might say, well, that sounds like another entitlement. The Republicans are against entitlements. But I would argue it's this. And in today's world, you can't argue that there's not income inequality. I don't care what your politics are. We have income inequality. The question is, what are you going to do about it? The Democrats would say, let's just redivide the pie. But I would argue their math doesn't work. And the only thing that can change it is giving more people the opportunity to compete in an environment where more qualification and more technical training is needed than ever before. As Republicans, I think we could actually lead with that issue. And then we could say to folks who thought, well, we're not a college-going family, say, well, yes, you are, and it's free, and here's why you need to start thinking about that in third grade.
Bread and butter economics. It sounds like you want to fight with Bernie Sanders for the hearts and minds of working class voters.
Well, I mean, we don't just believe these things because they benefit rich people or because there's some self-interest in it. But we actually think that's how things work best, that we think our whole system of democratic capitalism has created the best economy in the world. And one of my fears is that you have a younger generation that is just saying, A, I'm getting turned off by the whole politics thing. B, every time I hear and read about business, it sounds like they're the bad guys. And where we say, no, that's actually, it's a great system for creating opportunity. And I'll take my system over Bernie's system in terms of producing better outcomes every day.
You know, Governor, I think a lot of young people would love a policy of free community college championed by a Republican. And then I think they might click to the next news item and see that Republicans are passing a tax bill that makes tuition taxable income and say, wait a second, that's not the party for me at all.
For me, I look at that tax bill and say it's doing something really big. And this is what some of your listeners, given the geography, probably don't like, is I think we're doing the right thing and taking away the ability to deduct your state and local taxes against federal taxes. Our whole system of federalism was set up saying every state gets to decide how they want to run things. And if you want to have a really generous program and tax people more, that's your privilege. You get to go do that. But you shouldn't make the rest of the country subsidize that for you. And that's the system we have today.
So, Governor, how are we going to know? Let's give you a couple years. I think 2018 is going to be good for Democrats. That's a midterm. Donald Trump's unpopular. We get that. How are we going to know, when I look back on this conversation now, that the advice that you're giving today for your party to appeal to a broader base of Americans has started to take root?
The argument that I would make is this. Look what we can do as Republicans if we elect the right people. Again, we have 33 governors around the country in all these blue states. And my point would be, we have arguments that resonate with folks, but we can't just write off a big chunk of the country and realistically expect to have the right to govern.
Can you write them in with Donald Trump still being the leader of the Republican Party? Be honest.
I'll say this. If the economy keeps going and people's economic circumstances keep improving, people are going to have a whole different view.
Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee, thank you, sir.
Thanks. I enjoyed visiting. Look forward to talking again.
And that's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. Thanks for being here. Vail is about 25 miles southeast of Tucson. It's a rural area. Think wide open spaces. The Vail School District encompasses 425 square miles.
Last spring, district officials sat down to brainstorm how they were going to fill more than 100 empty teaching positions. Attracting enough teachers is a constant struggle for the district.
John Carruth is associate superintendent with the Vail School District.
And And one of the barriers for us in recruitment and retention is that there is no affordable housing within our school district. Of that 425 square miles, for example, there are no apartment complexes.
That means young teachers might opt to live in a more affordable place outside Vail and commute in.
When someone floated the idea of tiny homes for teachers, there were chuckles, but then there was talk that maybe that wasn't such a bad idea.
And the district recently purchased about 14 acres of land. Part of that comprises the original town site of Vail. It is within walking distance to three of our schools. It is walking distance to a grocery store that will open in February. And it's walking distance to a few restaurants in the area.
The tiny idea grew into a master plan for 24 homes.
Rent would go back to the district, and Carruth says the living expenses will be the same or even cheaper than living in an apartment outside Vail.
He says this isn't meant to be in place of bigger solutions like higher teacher pay, but with salary packages, they don't have as much wiggle room to get creative.
We're trying to do something that we, within the bounds of what we have control over in this market and in the environment with which we live in Arizona, and our staff are already paying for housing somewhere. And what we're really trying to do is provide them a highly attractive, high quality option that might be smaller, but that's located here.
They're still looking at different funding options outside of the regular budget, but Carruth says they haven't found a blueprint to turn to.
We have not been able to find examples of somebody who's already done this. There was another school district, interestingly, outside of Vail, Colorado, that was also looking to do something similar, but to my understanding, they haven't.
They plan to have four tiny homes ready to go by next summer for any teachers ready to downsize to roughly 250 square feet.
The tiny house movement is also getting bigger in northern Arizona, where the median price for a single-family home is higher than Metro Phoenix.
And KJZZ's Christina Estes joins us now to talk more about what's happening in the high country. Hey, Christina.
Good morning. When Coconino County started hearing from people interested in building tiny homes, they realized they didn't have codes that fit. So Amanda Atchison, the program manager for sustainable buildings, and her team got to work. They created a permitting process for houses smaller than 400 square feet.
They do require special codes for height in particular. And then for us, because we have adopted the energy code, which is a part of the International Residential Code, we allowed some flexibility on the insulation requirements. So we did allow for a decrease in insulation requirements, but we know that that still meets the spirit of the energy code, the intent of the energy code. Because the houses are smaller, they use less energy. They're very tight in construction, so they don't have a lot of air leakage and things like that. So they perform really well with in regards to energy use.
Why do tiny houses need codes? They're so small, someone might look at them and think it's kind of government just trying to get in the way of somebody who wants to live in a small space. So why do you think having specific codes for tiny houses are important?
Every house, every dwelling unit, every building has to meet a minimum life safety code, and that ensures not only the life and safety of the occupant inside it, being able to escape in times of fire, making sure, you know, carbon monoxide's not an issue, making sure their electric is safe, making sure their plumbing isn't causing problems, but it's also helps to ensure the safety of the communities that they reside in.
You know, I was really trying to get a sense of what 400 square feet looked like and felt like, and just doing some quick research online, in general, the description seemed to be the equivalent to roughly a two-car garage. When you go into a tiny house, how does it feel to you?
When I first was going into a tiny house, I was anticipating that it would also feel like an RV or a travel trailer, and I was very surprised going in because it felt more open and spacious and felt more like a home than a travel vehicle, an RV, does. And I think part of that reason is that tiny homes are being built with the similar material or the same material as a regular house. So they're framed similar to a house, and then they use windows that would go into a house. A big difference that I also notice is the diversity of space use. So in an RV or a travel trailer, the couch and everything is typically built into the unit, where in a tiny house, people bring in furniture and then they can move that furniture as needed within that tiny house.
What's been the response since these codes took effect earlier this year, both from people who might be interested as well as developers and builders? What are you hearing?
A great response. People are very appreciative of it. What we've done is created a path for folks who want to do it and do it safe and do it legally.
So do you think you're going to see a bunch of tiny houses built on a parcel where you might right now just see one house?
No, because with our current zoning, you could have one tiny house and then one accessory dwelling unit on a regular single-family home zoned lot. But in areas zoned for multifamily or for commercial uses, we could definitely see more than one or two tiny houses going in. So it just depends on where it's zoned. But we don't want community members that are living in areas zoned for single-family homes to think that all of a sudden there's going to be five tiny houses right next to them. And that's why zoning exists. It helps to create consistency in character, neighborhood characteristics, as well as helps to protect the investment of the community members within that neighborhood.
How many tiny houses do you have in Coconino County? Do you know, or do you know what to expect going forward?
We are currently working with five tiny house projects. None of them are 100% complete, but we are expecting in the next several months that they will be finaled. There is a new tiny house manufacturer here locally that's getting set up, so I think we'll probably be seeing quite a few more. We almost daily get calls and people coming in with an interest in doing tiny houses, either as an individual project or doing a tiny house community. And it's a way for us to address the diversity of housing needs. Housing affordability is a big challenge in our community, and as well as having a good housing supply. So a lot of people are looking at tiny houses as an opportunity for affordable housing and transitional housing, whether it's a student or a young professional just starting out and looking for a starter house, or somebody who's retiring looking to simplify.
Amanda Atchison is the Sustainable Buildings Program Manager in Coconino County.
Now, Christina, is anything similar to this happening here in Maricopa County?
Well, I checked with them, and a spokesman says they've issued permits for approximately five tiny houses, all single-story. However, the county doesn't have a definition for tiny houses, so it's unclear how big or how small those houses are. Right now, Maricopa County has no specific rules for tiny houses, and I'm told that they must follow the same process as other single-family houses.
All right, that's KJZZ's Christina Estes. Thanks, Christina.
You're welcome. Bye, Steve.
Good Tuesday morning. This is the show on KJZZ 91.5 with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Later this hour, we'll find out how a wildfire has decimated an endangered species in southeastern Arizona.
But first, there's been a space battle raging above our heads and has nothing to do with the new Star Wars film. Presidential administrations have been directing NASA to prepare to go back to the moon, then switching that to Mars. And now President Trump has changed the trajectory back to our own satellite, the moon. So are we really ready for another moonshot? And what's the purpose? For some of those answers, we turn to Brendan Byrne, space reporter for WMFE Orlando and host Are We There Yet? Mars podcast. Brendan, thanks for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
First of all, being a space reporter is your title. Sounds pretty cool, just to start with that.
It's the best job in the world.
So why did the moon ultimately win out this time, at least as far as perception goes, over Mars?
Well, Mars is still the long-term goal for the space program. It's that stepping stone between low Earth orbit and Mars that has changed between administrations. So under the Obama administration, we were looking at it was called a flexible goal, and they were looking at going to an asteroid. But now, with the Trump administration, he's saying we should put boots on the moon before we go to Mars, and it's basically learn how to live and work in deep space and prepare ourselves for an eventual trip to Mars.
What kind of cost are we looking at? Because NASA has seen its budget reduced in the past few years. How much money would this take?
Well, I mean, I've looked at some preliminary numbers here. Right now, NASA gets about $19 billion a year, with about $4 to $5 billion going towards the Space Launch System and Orion. Now, this would be the rocket and the capsule that would take humans to the moon. It looks like NASA would need about another $4 or $5 billion a year to expedite a trip to Mars like this.
Brendan, what sort of competition are we looking at, both from private companies, but even some other nations? Because there has been some collaboration when it comes to the International Space Station, for example. But in other aspects, this seems like maybe the beginning of another space race?
Possibly. Just recently, NASA signed a joint contract with the Russian Space Agency to begin looking at making the Deep Space Gateway. Now, this would be kind of like the International Space Station, but for the moon. So there would be some international collaboration with the Russian Space Agency. Private companies have stepped in and said they'd be more than happy to support NASA's mission to the moon. Not one company has come in and said, you know, we want to do it ourselves. Blue Origin, which is run by Amazon's Jeff Bezos, has said he wants to create a delivery system for NASA if they needed supplies sent to the moon. SpaceX has said they would work with NASA as well. So it looks like it's going to be a collaborative effort at this point. There are some other space agencies out there that are looking to establish a presence on the moon as well, like the Chinese Space Agency. But they've suffered some setbacks this year that are pushing that back to the long term.
Are there things that going to the moon will help us learn ultimately in an attempt to go to Mars?
Oh, absolutely. Just for some perspective, we operate in low Earth orbit now in the International Space Station. That's 150-some miles above our heads, whereas the moon is 239,000 miles. So that's a big step right there. Mars, at its closest, is about 33 million miles away. So this has been described to me as a trip to the moon is kind of like camping in your backyard before you hike the Appalachian Trail. You learn how to live and work in deep space, and if you're in trouble, you're only about 6 days away from the moon, as opposed to 9 months away when you're on Mars.
Now, Brendan, philosophically, when people go back to the 1960s, the moonshot, as we referenced when we started, and President Kennedy, and there was this great accomplishment, and almost it seemed like a collective accomplishment in the same sense, that all Americans were really excited about this. Do we need something like that again in some sense, not to be too philosophical here, but the idea that something that everyone can get behind, and is that a possibility these days, or are people sort of too jaded because, hey, we already went to the moon?
You know, that's a good question, and I think you really do need public support like this. I mean, if you're going to pump in another $5 billion onto a moonshot, and it's tough to get the public off the perception that, hey, we've already done this. You know, I think that's the job of NASA is to sell this and to go ahead and show that there's some really interesting things that we can still learn from the moon. I think with this administration, Vice President Mike Pence is very sold on heading to the moon, and he's, since the National Space Council was established, this administration, he's really done a lot of work making this happen. So I would expect that this administration would really push this very hard, and hopefully public support will be behind it.
Brendan Byrne is host of the Are We There Yet Mars podcast, and also has the coolest title around, space reporter for WMFE Orlando. Brendan, thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This year has seen a handful of high-profile shootings from Las Vegas to Sutherland Springs, Texas. And it's also seen calls to end gun violence. But some experts say doing that would require research. Research the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention used to do, but no longer does. Mark Rosenberg used to do that work. He was the founding director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC, but left the agency in 1999 after it stopped doing research into preventing gun violence. And Mark, it sounds like the kinds of questions you'd ask about this, what's the problem, what are the causes, how do you make it better, and how do you implement that, those seem like the same kinds of questions you'd ask to deal with other public health questions, like dealing with the opioid epidemic or whether seatbelts work, something like that. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
It's absolutely right. And the reason that we believe in the effectiveness of science to protect us is we'd seen what it had done in other areas. Asking and answering these same four questions a few years before had led to the eradication of smallpox through the simple application of these scientific questions And tremendous strides have been made in cancer, finding very effective treatments for cancer, where now people with cancers that had been a death sentence could live for years and years because they asked and answered these questions. Or tobacco-related diseases. And we said, look, the research had saved lots and lots of lives from another injury, from motor vehicle deaths. There are just about as many deaths each year from gunshot injuries, but no science was being done. The federal government was not funding any research in this area. And we said, wow, this could be really productive. It could get us out of this jam where we are. So we were very excited, and we thought that science could really get us out of the morass where we were stuck. And this was 20 years ago.
So do you think then that policymakers, be they in Congress or on the state or local levels, are essentially flying blind right now when they are debating and considering gun type legislation or ordinances, be it expanding gun rights or working on issues of gun control?
It's actually worse than flying blind. They're flying blind and they're the only ones in the plane. And it's very much akin to another problem that we had. And I can't blame legislators. I can't blame politicians because we're not giving them the information that they need to know whether the laws that we're asking them to vote on are safe and effective. Nobody wants to have happen in their hometown what happened in Sutherland, Texas. We have some common goals here, and we can take both goals into account when we do the research to find things that work. We can find things that work both to reduce gun violence and to protect the rights of law-abiding gun owners.
Do you think, though, that in the political climate, and I know you're a public health guy, you're not a political guy, but do you think that in the current political climate that there would be consensus to buy into what a scientific study on something like the issue of guns found on either side?
I do. I do think there are enough scientists with different perspectives and on different parts of the spectrum who could come together and formulate the research questions. We know what the questions basically are. What's the problem? What are the causes? What works? And how do you do it? Where I think we need agreement is how we measure those interventions that we will deem successful. And I think we can say that to be successful, it has to show two things: that it reduces gun violence, and secondly, that it does not infringe on the rights of law-abiding gun owners.
In the absence of federal research, are there other entities doing this kind of research, be it on the state level or NGOs or other advocacy groups that are doing this kind of research?
There are. There are some groups that are doing this research, and there are some outstanding researchers. But the questions are big questions. And if you want to find out, for example, if banning the sale of semi-automatic rifles will reduce mass shootings, you have to do a pretty large study over a lot of different jurisdictions over a long period of time. So these are big and expensive studies. The expense of the research is nothing compared to the expense of losing the lives that we lose today from gunfire. But you need large studies that are well-coordinated, well-designed, that span different geographic jurisdictions. And CDC is perfectly placed to do studies like that, to design studies like that, with input from both gun rights people and from gun control people, with inputs from scientists all along the spectrum. So we have researchers ready. We have institutions that are ready. I think we just need people to understand that now is the time to start.
Mark Rosenberg was the founding director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. He's out of government now and is working to get funding restored to the CDC to do research on preventing gun violence.
Time Magazine's 2017 Person of the Year is the women who have spoken out about sexual harassment. The issue has resulted in the firings and resignations of powerful men in a number of fields, most prominently entertainment, media, and politics.
In some cases, a common theme seems to be a lot of people heard about the allegations but never did anything, often described as an open secret. KJZZ's Christina Estes talked with a philosophy professor who has another word for the behavior. Christina joins us now. Christina, I hesitate to ask, but what's the word?
It's himpathy, a play on the word sympathy. But before we get to Cornell University philosophy professor Kate Mann's take on himpathy, I asked her to define sexism and misogyny. She started by talking about patriarchal social structure, certain areas where women play supportive, nurturing, and subordinate roles.
Sexism is the ideology that supports these patriarchal social structures. So it's a theory that women are particularly well suited to play these feminine coded roles, and that men are better suited than women to play roles that are traditionally masculine coded, like in business, leadership, certain sports, certain academic pursuits, including philosophy. And so that's sexism. And I think of misogyny as the kind of policing and enforcement of those roles when they seem to be in danger of being on the wane.
I noticed that you didn't say a hatred of women, because if you Google misogyny, Merriam-Webster and other sites will talk about it being a hatred of women. Can it just be someone's personal views and philosophies, or a family's view and philosophy, that there are certain gender roles or norms and that's the way I prefer to think?
So I think that misogyny can manifest itself in hate. It can be a psychological property of individuals who are hateful towards women. But I think it's often not directed at any and every woman, so much as women who don't play the relevant social roles, or who are represented as or deemed the epitome of women of a type who aren't playing the right social roles. So I think that the traditional definition of misogyny is too narrow. And it also focuses mistakenly on people's psychology on the part of someone who's misogynistic, whereas I think it's helpful to focus instead on the hateful and hostile reactions women face, not because they're represented as women in a man's mind, but because they're women in a man's world, a historical patriarchy.
In your book, you also highlight another word, himpathy. What does that mean?
So I think that just as misogyny is often about punishing and guilting and shaming women who are bad by the lights of patriarchal and sexist ideology, the flip side of that is extending too much sympathy and forgiveness and spinning exonerating narratives about boys and men who commit misogynistic acts. In a way, himpathy is the flip side of misogyny, and it also is something which misogyny encourages people in general, but I think women in particular, to practice, to be very oriented to being sympathetic to men who complain of a predicament which, frankly, is their due to their own bad behavior, such as in instances where they've committed acts of sexual assault and or harassment.
When someone sort of steps outside of what is traditionally viewed as a male or female role or job, it can be unsettling to some people. So what do you think needs to be done to address that or to make it less unsettling, or can you?
Yeah, I think one possibility is that we just have to be very aware of our potentially taken aback and sometimes hostile reactions to people who don't conform to gender roles or don't conform to the gender binary. So that's, I think, one part of the answer is not to try to purify your soul of hostile reactions to, say, female politicians who will predictably appear kind of abrasive in certain contexts, particularly when they go head-to-head with male competitors, but to just be aware of that in oneself, that it could be like a visual illusion. So I think we need to do something analogous with respect to hostility we feel towards women that's often quite misleading. And that is, I think, not a symptom of bad character. I think it's something that most of, if not all of us, are capable of doing and feeling within a very historically patriarchal culture that has changed in certain ways quite rapidly.
Do women have a particular or special or different role, in your opinion, when it comes to addressing misogyny and misogynistic acts?
Yeah, I do. I think one way in which we can fight misogyny is by undoing some of the ties that bind falsely and illicitly. So a lot of the way in which misogyny keeps itself in business is by establishing these supposed moral obligations for women to be loyal to privileged men in their vicinity who have some kind of power over them, or are simply requiring women to be oriented to them and giving them attention and validation. But I think often trying to break out of the sense of guilt and shame in refusing to play those sorts of roles that are excessively demanded, I think that can go a long way to both freeing individual women, but also combating the social structures that misogyny consists in.
That was Kate Mann, author and philosophy professor at Cornell University, speaking with KJZZ's Christina Estes.
How many times have you made the decision to do something, and the result makes you wonder about whether it was a coincidence? Do things happen by chance? Are coincidences real? Scholars usually cite three possible causes of coincidences: probability, God or another higher force or being, and our subconscious. Dr. Bernard Beitman has studied coincidences for decades and is the first psychiatrist since Carl Jung to attempt to categorize and even explain them. He's in private practice in Charlottesville, Virginia, and is author of Connecting with Coincidence, and he's with me to talk about coincidences and how common and impactful they are. Dr. Beitman, do we characterize, just all of us, certain things as coincidences that really aren't?
You could say anything is a coincidence. A coincidence refers to the crossing of two different lines of life, two different experience lines. But when I'm talking about coincidences in the simplest form, it's that something that I am thinking happens in my environment. Something that's in my mind that appears in my environment in a surprising and hard to explain way.
When we are going about our daily lives and we come across someone for the first time, or someone that we have not seen for a long time, perhaps enters our mind, we get a phone call, we cross paths, something brings us together. Do we actually have more capacity to bring some of these events about, or is this controlled by some greater power in the universe? How much control do you think we have of this and making these happen?
Let's start with a simple answer to that. The more you pay attention to what's in your own mind and what's in your environment, the more coincidences you will see. So it begins with attention. It begins with awareness of your own mind and what's out there around you, of being alert, observe, observe, observe. So we do have that capacity. But then there's more and more evidence that we can imagine things and make them happen.
Is it better for us to think and know that we can have this kind of influence to bring about coincidences? Would it make our lives better to think that we have this power? Do we want to have control or do we not? Is it safer as humans to know it or not?
I think it's of vital importance in the state of the world now for human beings to gather together and imagine a better future than the one we appear to be developing.
When people are talking about a spiritual force or something greater in the universe and whatnot, we're sort of giving up responsibility in some ways for the decisions that we make to bring about coincidences, because not every coincidence is going to be a positive one, right?
Right. There are tricky ones. There are seductive ones. There are ones that can suggest the wrong path. It requires an ethical capacity in each of us to be able to choose a coincidence to build on. But the idea of being able to do it ourselves or do it through some spiritual force outside, a wonderful question, Steve. And there are two ways to answer that. There are those people who think that coincidences are all probability. It's all can be explained by statistics. And there are others who will always say that coincidences are created by God. In both instances of probability and God, the human being does not have responsibility. It's out of his or her hands. I'm trying to suggest that there is a collaboration between our minds, our intentions, and probability and higher powers to help create coincidences in varying degrees of contribution of each one. But what I come to have to believe, and it's getting easier for me to say because I'm somewhat skeptical. I try to be scientific. I try to look for evidence. But it looks like there are higher intelligence around us, that there are intelligences to which we can tune in and can help guide us and are maybe guiding us without our being aware of it until a good coincidence takes place. And it's almost like this phrase of coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. Once you have a coincidence, God is no longer anonymous. There are some outside forces influencing us, but we are contributing also.
How do you think it affects how we make our decisions? If we become more aware that coincidences are all around us, does it give us more of feeling more comfortable with those decisions and what they are?
Absolutely. Once you learn how to read the coincidences in a positive way for yourself, become able to expect them in your life. They are just things that happen. I had a blood pressure problem. My blood pressure went up pretty high, and my primary care physician got a little nervous and said, "You got to go to a cardiologist." And so I called a physician that I knew and asked him to make a referral, and I got a call that day, "Would you like to come in tomorrow to see the cardiologist at 10 or 10:30? And I said, "Okay, 10:30, so I can sleep a little longer." And it turned out this guy didn't have any more openings until 3 months later. It just happened to open up for me. How did that happen? Well, I don't know. I've gotten used to those sorts of things happening and come to expect them.
Dr. Beitman, you've said that there are ways to bring about more coincidences in our lives. So from your work and research, what are those ways?
One is to be alert to them during times of transition. That could be traveling. It could be somebody has died. It could be during a wedding. It could be when you're sick. It could be when you're changing jobs. But in periods of transition, the kind of ordinary net of reality tears open, and it allows more coincidences to take place. So be alert to them during transitions. The second is to be able to tune into your own intuition. Develop your own intuition. Learn to know your own mind, your feelings, your fantasies, so that you can remember them and see how they connect with your environment, with the people around you, with the thoughts around you, with the internet around you, which is a very common source of coincidences, as well as radio programs like this. And there may be people listening to us, Steve, who can just tune in to one of the things we said and said, "Yeah, I was just thinking that."
Dr. Bernard Beitman is a psychiatrist who studies coincidences, and he's the author of Connecting with Coincidence.
An endangered species native to Arizona is in trouble. This summer's Fry Fire burned more than 48,000 acres around Mount Graham in southeastern Arizona, and that's led to a dramatic decrease in the number of red squirrels found there. With me to talk about this is Marit Allinen, a fish and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Tucson. And Marit, how dire exactly is this situation?
That is a good question. We are very concerned, considering that the latest population estimate is about 35 individuals, and that's down from 252 or so in 2016.
And how much of that do you attribute to wildfires in the area?
That particular decline, it does seem related to the Fry Fire that occurred this last summer. That fire burned about 48,000 acres, and a lot of that was within the range of the red squirrel and within its habitat. I believe about 78% of the range of the squirrel was affected by that fire in some capacity. And red squirrels really, they're attracted to areas of forest that are pretty dense and have a lot of cover. And so some of the higher severity effects of that fire, we are seeing in areas where red squirrels occurred, which is definitely attributable to some of their decline.
Is it possible that when the fires came, the squirrels just went somewhere else? I mean, for lack of a better word, they evacuated and maybe were not part of this most recent count?
That is quite possible, and that's what gives us hope, too. Some of the work that the University of Arizona has done has documented that squirrels will move after a fire, and they can successfully survive a fire. So one of the projects that we want to do is to get some satellite imagery so that we can look at the forest as a whole, and including places that we haven't been to or that, you know, it's so remote up there, it's hard to do a complete survey of all of the range that they might inhabit. So we want to look at the satellite imagery to see if there are pockets of habitat that remain, and then go there and see if there are squirrels there, or those pockets could perhaps end up serving as places where we could translocate squirrels if we determine that that's something that we might need to do. Additionally, the Phoenix Zoo has a pilot captive breeding program for the red squirrel, and we haven't produced young through that yet, but I think we're pretty close. And so when the young are produced, those areas on the mountain of remaining habitat could be areas where we could locate squirrels from the zoo.
Now, we're obviously heading into winter, which is, especially on top of Mount Graham, a particularly difficult time, I would imagine, for wildlife to survive. Are you particularly concerned given the time of year we're in now and where the population stands?
We are, because red squirrels are pretty interesting in that they create what's called a midden in their habitat or in their territory. And in that midden is where they bury all of their food that helps get them through the winter because they don't hibernate. And what happened with the fire is that a lot of these middens either partially burned or completely burned, which means that the food that the squirrel needs, even if the squirrel survived, they may not have the food to get them through the winter. And so we have come up with a project. This is a group of people that are either managers or experts with red squirrels. So we've started a supplemental feeding program where we've built some feeders that we are putting at locations where we know the squirrels are and filling them with rodent chow.
If the efforts to help and ultimately save the red squirrel are not successful, besides the sadness over losing a species, what will it mean that this particular species of animal is not around anymore?
Tree squirrels, including red squirrels, they're excellent indicators of forest health because they're so dependent on mature forests for food, for nest sites, for cover, and for these microclimates where they store their food. So we would lose that indicator, and that's probably indicating that we're having some issues in that forest. They're also interesting because, like I said, they build these middens where they store their food. And because this is like a concentrated source of food, these middens also provide food for other small mammals, or in some cases even large mammals like bears. The small mammals then provide a food source for some predators who may be attracted to middens because of this sort of concentrated small mammal population there. And so if we lose the red squirrel, we lose their middens. We may lose these small concentrated populations of small mammals, and then it just cascades up through the predators as well. So we run the risk of losing more than we might think if we were to lose the red squirrel on the mountain.
Marit Alanen is a fish and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Tucson. Marit, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.